session number 21735, Reel 4.
Bob Shrimpton, Reel 4. Bob, you were just mentioning grenade practice.
Yeah, they suddenly decided that they'd give the Home Guard training on hand grenades for close combat. And across the common over here behind the canal, there was a training ground where the army had dug a lot of slit trenches. And we were taken out there, and this instructor would open up this box, and he'd pick up this thing that looked like a small pineapple, and he'd say, "This is a hand grenade. All you do, you pull out this pin, you let the handle go, and you throw it." We thought, well, that's easy enough. And he said, "You've only got 10 seconds to get out of the way." And so I think what the lads wanted to do then was to see how they could throw the thing first. He said, "Don't lob it, hurl it." And you had to learn how to stand in a slit trench and hurl this thing over your head, right-handed, over the top of the head in an arc, remembering you had to count how many seconds after you let the handle go before you threw it, and you had to estimate how far the slit trench you were aiming for was in front of you, and how long it would take you to hit it, because the instructor would always say, "If you throw it too soon, it lands in the slit trench, they'll throw it back at you." It was quite daunting to start with, but we thought it was hilarious fun in the end. Luckily, we had never had any accidents. But we did have a tragedy in later years after I'd come out of the Navy. It was always great fun for children to play it over there. And one of our young scouts went over there and picked up this grenade that must have been laying there all those years, threw it to his mate, and his mate threw it back, and it was still alive, and it blew his leg off. He's still around. He survived, but it just shows you the tragedies that can happen, even from practicing, even though the signs are all up all over the place. Do not pick up any suspect object, because there's still quite a lot of live ammunition left over there.
You mentioned the difference there, that the instructor would say, "Don't lob it, hurl it."
That's right.
Is that difficult to actually manage when you've actually got a live grenade in your hand?
Well, we practiced with dummy ones to start with, and I think that was the important thing. But when you had the live one in your hand and you looked at it, and you think, well, once I let go of that handle, I'm going to get rid of it just as soon as I can. And I think you had the motivation there. I mean, there's still accidents happen, even this modern day and age. I mean, this young Royal Marine quite recently was shot with live ammunition on a training exercise. How did that live ammunition get into somebody's rifle? So these accidents happen. But a lot of accidents happened in those days. Luckily, we didn't have any around here. But it just showed this sort of thing can be lethal.
Were you quite safety conscious?
I don't think the emphasis was on safety so much then as it is now. I don't think people were worried too much about safety. If an accident happened, an accident happened. There was no inquiries. There was no room for compensation. So I don't think we were too worried about the safety aspects of things. You had to use your common sense, knowing that you had something lethal in your hands.
When you threw the grenade, did you have to watch its fall before you took cover?
Well, you had to watch to see if it was going in the right direction, then duck quick. I mean, you were mentally counting your 10 seconds. So you'd look to see if you've gone into the right direction and then duck. And then, you know, put your hands in your ears and wait. If it didn't go off, you got worried then, because then you'd have to go and find it.
Did any of yours not go off?
No, I don't think we ever got caught in that situation. No, I don't think we ever got caught in that situation. We were only allowed about 3 grenades to throw in practice, because ammunition was getting scarce. I mean, even now, they're not allowed to fire X number of blanks or flash canisters now because of the expense.
So did you have any other training on any other things? You mentioned, obviously, grenades, rifles, the grenade thrower, and the machine guns.
No, no. Well, only that wretched cannon. Smith cannon. Smith cannon, yeah. That's the only things, though. Would that and of course, well, the normal gas mask drills and that sort of thing.
Oh, can you tell me about gas mask drill?
Well, we were fitted out with a military gas mask, the same as the standard regimented issue in those days. And we would, they had a building over in Aldershot, which was like a training building for gas, but it was filled with smoke. And you had to count X number of seconds after somebody would shake gas, and you had to know how to knock your helmet back, put your mask on, and pull the helmet back over, and you had only so many seconds in which to do it. So, I mean, it was standard gas mask drill that everybody went through.
With the drill, did they give you any taste of the gas at all? Without your helmet
No, they only use smoke. You use a smoke canister. But, I mean, I think it was the same, really, with the... At school, we were fitted out with you know, the square box with the gas mask on, and sitting in a classroom, you have to... So they say... Headmaster open the door, shake gas, and everybody open their boxes and put this gas mask on. If you've been running around the field beforehand, sweating profusely, first thing, your two goggles got misty up, you couldn't see a damn thing.
What did your uniform and equipment look like? What did you have with the Home Guard? Was it
battle dress, khaki battle dress, same as the Army were fitted out with. A forage cap, steel helmet, and putties round the ankle, or gaiters rather, round the ankles, and boots. But it was a standard military equipment.
And would you have the same webbing?
Yes, the same webbing, and your knapsack, and your gas mask holders, and your ammunition pouches, exactly the same. Yeah.
And you mentioned obviously the different companies and which company you were in. Was there a unit name at all for the whole unit?
I can't remember now.
I'll take it if you're one of the Hampshire ones.
It'd be probably North East Hampshire or something like that. I mean, I don't think it's a. I can't remember us having a now. I think everybody worked more or less as companies in the area and linked up with one another. But I can't remember having. Like a regimental sort of title.
How many times a week would you meet with the Home Guard?
Oh, I think it would probably be twice a week, and then weekend, of course, on training exercises.
Would you do guard duties at all?
No, we didn't do guard duties. No, there's no guard duties as such. No, we didn't. Not in our factory, anyway. Because I think the majority of the installations around here was undertaken by the military personnel or the Air Force Regiment would do it as well.
And at this time, although you were having all the military training with the Home Guard, did you have any inclinations that you might like to go into the Army? Rather than
no,
the Navy?
No. I always remember doing a parade up on the Views Meadow. And a visiting commanding officer of the Aldershot Division, I think it was, came in and he did an inspection. And he said, "You boy, your father in the Army?" I said, "Yes, sir, Hampshire Regiment." "You going to join him?" "No, sir, I'm going to join the Navy." You've seen the look on his face. No way. I mean, I'd done this military training because it was something I could do. But I set my mind on I'm going to volunteer for the Navy before I ever get anywhere near calling up age.
Because, of course, in 1941, there was the sinking of the Bismarck.
That's right.
And do you have any memories of that time at all?
Only, of course, in those days, we only read the newspapers, and I then thought what a formidable ship that was. But the tenacity of the Royal Navy following it through those... And when you come to think of it, it's pretty hazardous conditions out there at sea. It's not like wandering around Portsmouth Harbour. I mean, one moment you can see a ship, the next minute it's completely out of sight. That is the size of the waves. And I was amazed at the tenacity of the British fleet there following that ship. They nearly lost sight of him, and he could have got adrift.
Was there a public reaction to the sinking of Hod?
There was a very bitter reaction. I mean, not bitter, just dumb shock, I think. Because I don't even realise that some of the survivors of when the Belfast broke her back after being mined, the crew were dispersed. Some of the members were transferred to the Hood, and they were lost. I mean, that is a tragic situation, and it's the bond between Belfast and Hood. But I think the public reaction at the time was just dumb shock. That here was applied to the Navy, surely it couldn't have happened. There must have been an accident of some sort, you know.
Would you have said that the Hood was considered the pride of the Navy, or one of the
I think it was the subject of a lot of odes and poems and writings, and I think it was the pride, HMS Hood, because Admiral Hood was a great seafaring man from way back in the early Navy days. So I think they thought that was a pride. And I think there was a deep sense of shock. They thought, well, if that can be sunk, what on earth can we stop the German Navy with? We haven't got anything, you know.
I mean, what was the general atmosphere as you got into 1941? Because obviously there was quite a number of setbacks during 1941.
I think everybody realised that things were going to get really tough. And I think people were a little bit sombre about it, but you know, I don't think I ever heard of any defeatist talk. I mean, from media now you hear defeatist talk from some of the politicians and some of the top ranking people, but I mean, there was no such thing in everyday life of defeatism. No way. I always thought, well, you know, we just got to stick it out and tighten their belts a bit more.
Did people listen to William Joyce, Lord Haw Haw, at all on the radio?
Yeah, they did. I mean, and they used to think it was a great joke. It was, I think that was because our own commentators would say, or even the comedians we had on radio would say, oh, have you heard this voice? And then you hear Lord Haw Haw's voice. And, you know, what a clown that bloke is. And people expected, every time he switched it on, I don't think they put any emphasis in what he said at all. Mind you, I expect there were one or two of the probably anarchist type or even with fascist followings would have listened to it and believed it. But round here, no. It's just a comedy act.
Speaking of comedy acts, did you visit the cinema at all and see any of the films at the time? I was thinking of George Formby being very popular.
Oh, yeah. We had a cinema in Fleet then. Sixpence a time. The threat was on a Saturday matinee. That was hilarious. But, no, we used to... you see, there was very, very other entertainment. Not for young people, apart from youth clubs and football and sports and that sort of thing. But winter months, there was nothing. So we used to go to the cinema quite regularly and see all the older acts. There was a dance hall in Fleet for the older generation. That was always well attended, except the dance floor had a tip on it like that. And you start one end and landed up all a heap down the bottom end. But and a lot of the army personnel, which were billeted in Fleet in those days, would attend this and escort the young ladies around. But we used the cinema quite a bit. And, of course, Movie Town News was the highlight of the programme, because there you got the up-to-date action stories of the war.
You mentioned that troops were billeted in the area. Obviously, there must have been a big influx into the area at that time.
Yeah. You see, a lot of the big houses... the families had been evacuated away, or the the husband or had gone back into the army. So all they could be requisitioned. They would go in and say, look, we want X number of rooms from your house. And all along the Fleet Road, various big houses, all full of army. We've had Australians here, had New Zealanders, we've had Canadian. So we've had quite a lot of different regiments in this area.
Were the Australians and New Zealanders, was that around about 1940? Was it before they were sent to the Middle East?
Yes, around about that sort of time, 1940-41.
Were they here for very long?
No, the New Zealanders and Australians, they weren't here long, no. And then we had the Canadians here just before the Dieppe raids. And then, of course, after that, we had other different regiments. And I think we had the Black Watch at one time. And a lot of it, of course, was the build-up before the D-Day landings. Obviously, there was a greater influx of men coming in then. And, of course, a lot of the larger houses, like Bramshill College, Redfields, Brandon's Farm, which is now St Nicholas School, they were all officers' quarters. They were all requisitioned for officers' quarters.
You know, you mentioned that Fleet obviously has an army connection already. Mm. What were the relationships with the new influx of obviously regiments coming from outside and from abroad? What were the relations like with the civilians?
Oh yeah, I mean open house. It was when the Gurkhas were here quite recently. It was open house. Christmas time or anything like that. You know, open house. Come in, you know, have a meal. Oh, yeah. Mind you, you had the one or two clashes between the local lads and but you'll get that in any situation. You know, when the Yanks came into London and all this sort of thing with their money, you know, you had the clashes, but generally, it was open house, you know.
Was that because of the military background of the area, do you think, or was that generally across the country?
Oh, I think that was general across the country. I think, say, for instance, you went up to Hertfordshire or somewhere up there, and you were in a small village, and you're a young lad coming in from town. The older generation would say, that poor lad's lost, you know. Come and have a cup of tea, you know. And I think that they would, you know, mother them. So I think this was general. If you were displaced from your home environment and you were sent somewhere else, I mean, I felt it during the Navy time and up in Campbelltown, somewhere like that. You walk along the road and there would be a tap on the window, come and have a cup of tea. So I think that's the nature of the English people. Whether it's the same now or not, I don't know. But that was the nature of it then.
Yeah, would you say that that was a wartime thing that might be latent within the character, or but it was just the events that made that come out?
I think whenever there is any form of trauma, disaster, war, earthquake, it's the community spirit, everybody drops everything, animosity is forgotten, you help. That is probably the human bonding.
So we're coming up to the end of 1941. Again, another major naval event that you may have been following was the sinking of the Prince of Wales and repulsing...
Yeah, and sinking of HMS Barham. Now, I have a link with that. One of my skating instructors, and he was paymaster commander then, Royal Navy, which again inspired me. He retired as Rear Admiral, Keith Lauder, and I remember his son was midshipman on the Barham, and he lost his life. He had his son, midshipman, and two daughters. One in the Wrens, one in the ATS. And from that day, he never ever spoke about his son. And even after he retired down to Dartmoor, I visited him regularly with the Rover crew and all of us. Great friends. I still go to see his daughter, but he never ever mentioned his son until shortly before he died. And we were quietly walking through his paddock, and he just happened to say, pity my son's not here to take over the farm. And shortly after he died. But it's strange, another connection with the Barham again.
You mentioned the Barham and there's obviously the Prince of Wales and Repulse. Again, what was the reaction again as...
I think there, again, it was dumb shock, really. The nation couldn't understand why our fleet was being demolished. And remember, being a small country, shipyards were working flat out. But I think then the policy was beginning to change, that the big ships were not infallible. We proved this by the sinking of some German large battle cruisers, and we were losing large battleships of our own battle cruisers. And I think we had a modern conception then that what we needed was smaller, faster, more lethal type of navy. And I think that's where the conception was born.
And you were following all these events avidly, weren't
you? Avidly, yes. I think a lot of people were as well. I think a lot of the old boys probably former Navy, you know, might have thought the same thing. Because when you come to work it out, if you've got a ship the size of Renown or Hood or something like that, when you destroy that, you've just destroyed a town. A town of hundreds of people with great resources. If you hit a destroyer, you've only destroyed a village. So I think this is the conception of naval warfare came into it, started to come round a bit.
Particularly with the sinking of the Prince of Wales and Repulse, had you any feelings about the start of the war with the Japanese?
I think there was an inclination that this would happen because, remember, they'd already invaded Shanghai, and there we did have naval shipping. In actual fact, HMS Petrel was sunk by Japanese invading forces there, and I think there was a feeling that Japan, we would have to fight, but people were saying, why didn't the Americans come in and help us? Why didn't they come in and help us? But they were giving us leasehold food, and everybody thought that was hilarious because we were fighting to save a world from aggression. They were sending us food, which we've got to pay for in the end. That's something didn't quite go down right with a lot of people in this country, I'm afraid. They couldn't understand the reason. We're doing the fighting, they're feeding us, but we've got to pay them. They couldn't understand that.
So we're in 1941, 42. Are there any other memories you have of events of that period?
Just volunteering for the Navy.
So how did you go about volunteering for the Navy and when?
Well, my father, as you know, was away in the army, and my mother was doing war work, and I thought, I'm going to join the Navy. And Mr. Tapp, I went to see him, and he said, well, you're in reserved occupation. Not only that, you're underage. I said, well, I'll just tell him a lie. So one morning, I caught the bus to Reading, walked into the naval recruiting station, and dear old Petty, our chief petty officer there, retired, said, yes, lad, name. So I gave him a name. Age, 18. Birth certificate, I said, I've lost it. He said, what? I said, yeah, I think it was lost in an air raid. Oh, dear, my mother's going to kill me when I get home. So he said, right, took all the other details. And what are you doing? I said, in engineering. Right. Come back in 2 days for a medical. So I went home, didn't say anything to my mother, went back after 2 days for a medical. He said, right, report back here in 3 days, you'll have your bring a change of clothing. I went back home and told my mother I'd joined the Navy. Well, she didn't say anything for a few minutes. She just stood there looking at the kitchen window. She said, well, that's what we wanted to do. Better find you some clothes. I think she must have been pretty choked up inside.
Well, you mentioned your medical. What did that consist of?
Oh, yeah, well, it's not quite as it would be today. If you went today, they'd strap you up with the computerised tapes and sounding bits and pieces and all this sort of thing. I'm afraid in those days, you just walked in front of a doctor, stripped to your baby wear, and they say, any illnesses? No, sir. Look through your teeth. All right. Eyes any good? Yes, sir. Read those letters on the wall. Read them off. They said, right, stand aside, cough, right, you're in, next man. And that was it. I mean, the thing was, I think, in retrospect, it's quite understandable. We were running short of men, we were running short of everything, and we wanted to get men trained as quickly as possible. So any shortcuts could be made, and that's why I could lie about my age and get in with anybody asking any silly questions. I mean, I remember the chief police officer when he signed me on. I said, well, don't forget, if you can get a copy of birth certificate, I want to see it. Well, I thought, Tom, I get that, you'll be dead. But no, it was very perfunctory. But I don't think, I mean, I remember one chap was lodging here with my mother, who was in the army over here at Aldershot. He only had one eye, but he was in the army. So, I mean, everybody went through, if they were reasonably fit, and you were keen and intelligent. We did a bit of a small intelligence test, but that was it. You were in.
And the recruiting petty officer, do you think he was aware that you were underage?
Oh, I'm sure he was aware. I'm sure he was aware. I could see that sort of little glint in his eye. He kept staring up at me, you know, as if to say, you haven't even started shaving yet.